Welcome to this episode of Conquering Leadership. Today, our guest is James Holder, who's originally of the UK, but currently resident in Australia. And according to him, the safest place to be in the COVID pandemic is Western Australia, because whilst there's lots of horrible snakes that kill you as soon as look at you, they don't have much COVID going on down there, which is pick your poison, I suppose, in that list of lovely choices. James comes from the world of veterinary medicine, which is quite exciting for me because I've been looking for a guest on the show that comes from a medical background, and we don't very often dig deep into leadership in that world, or specifically in the world of veterinary medicine. So he's been a veterinarian as opposed to veteran, or veteran of foreign wars or any wars. So he's been a vet for more than 20 years. He's a director of two clinics in Perth in Western Australia, and also partner in a company that has veterinarian clinics up in China, in Shanghai. James not only is a proclaimed veterinarian, he's also self-proclaimed mentor, teacher, and striver for fabulousness in his profession of choice. So, James, it's great to have you here. And how's that for an intro?
Well, a little bit different, but pretty good, I think.
So tell us a little bit more about yourself and the veterinarian world. How did you get into that? And I know in simplistic terms, it's looking after the well-being of animals, but expand on that a little bit for us, if you don't mind.
How did I get into it? Well, I had to make some choices when I was young about what subjects to study. And so my mum said, you better go and decide. And I went back and I'd said, I don't want to sit behind a desk and I want to do something practical. But I have no idea at 14 what that means as a job. And so my mum said, well, you like animals, go to the vets. So I went to the vets and I loved it and went every holidays, every waking minute, and I still love it.
And that's and are you working with like domestic animals, farm animals, wild animals?
So majority of my patients are dogs and cats, but yep. We see quite a lot of wildlife here because the native wildlife in WA is the whole of Australia has quite a unique breadth of fauna, but WA has its own lot, and so we get brought lots from the public finding animals injured, hit by cars and so on. So yeah, we see lots of different things, spiny echidnas to lots of different types of birds. We've got one of our nurses is rehabilitating a butcher bird chick at the moment because it's a native bird. Yeah, so we get those.
So just in that paragraph alone, a spiny echidna and a butcher bird.
Yeah.
So for those of us who are uneducated, like myself, well, what are they?
So an echidna is an Australian anteater. And they're small, like a porcupine from a US point of view, but a bit smaller. Lots of the spines and a long little nose like that. And you can't actually examine them because as soon as they feel sick or threatened, they roll up into a big spiny ball. So you have to anaesthetize them to then be able to examine them. So they're quite a challenge. They're quite fun.
Yep.
And a butcher bird is, well, I don't know a lot about these coming from the UK either, but they're native bird. And there's a lot of birds over from the east and a lot of released captive birds like people have brought over. And yep. So butcher birds are native. So we want to look after these guys in particular and not worry so much about the overpopulation of the introduced species.
So what's the difference between an introduced species and an invasive species?
Well, not all introduced species are successful. So an accidental introduction of a species, they might not survive in that environment. You know, Australia is quite a classic, you know, that with the cane toads and things that have rabbits, feral cats, probably the top three disaster areas in Australian history. Camels, there's more camels free roaming in Australia than the Arabian Peninsula, they reckon. they're less destructive and they provide actually a source of food and transport and entertainment. So they're not necessarily so invasive.
Why do people go to a country and decide to bring an animal with them outside of pets? I mean, pets, obviously, but it's always struck me as a bit bizarre. We turn up to Australia and bring a herd of camels.
Because they didn't know how to cross that. And they know, okay, what desert do we know? What animals do we know are good in desert? This seems like that. So let's bring some of those on. Transport and food are why we have animals. And, you know, companion animals have come after that. Dogs were working. Cats were working animals. You know, that's how they started with us. Horses are working animals. Cattle working animals. You know, then they became food animals. And, you know, then somebody has the little lamb in the house. That's a companion animal.
Yeah, I remember growing up, actually, and you mentioned that. It's quite interesting because, yeah, we had cats and dogs in the house. But then we went to the farm, and the farm, the cats were ratters. They all served the purpose. Yeah. And the dogs were, you know, for keeping foxes away, for hunting purposes. Basically, the animals were working in the sense that they're vermin killers or predator killers.
They have a role to play in making the farm or the business work properly. And, you know, that's why I think camels came over, because they're actually very effective. Horses can survive, but they're not as good. Go for a big, long trek. There's a couple of documentaries of people crossing Australia with camels.
You mentioned horses there. Does Australia have its own breed of horse? Is the horse native to Australia?
I'm not sure if it's native. They're introduced. But, yeah, wild horses are called Brumbies. ACT.
Yeah, I was going to say, everything comes back to rugby eventually. And
yeah.
Well, you're mature like myself, and you've been in the industry since you were a jobbing teenager. Yeah. So in your professional career, just before we dig into the leadership side, what changes have you seen in the world of veterinary medicine?
I think the biggest change is the expectation of the owner as to what should happen and their general understanding and knowledge base, so they can challenge or direct what happens a little bit more, whereas previously it was going to the vet, I have no idea what's going on, I'll just take the recommendation of whatever the vet says. But that's totally different to now. And, you know, there is a lot more that we can do. Even from when I graduated over 20 years ago, the drugs are different. The knowledge that we have about diseases, the better solutions to surgical problems, yep. You know, they've all improved as well. Imaging has gone massively, you know, with CTs and MRIs. We can now see things completely different. We can plan way better. We can get much better results.
Is there much cross-collaboration or cooperation between the worlds of animal medicine and human medicine?
There's a movement called One Health, which is designed to try and bring those two areas together. I mean, a lot of research is done on animals prior to done on humans.
Yeah.
And if they don't brew, then they may go into the animal stream. And there's lots of people researching coronavirus in humans and coronavirus in cats, for instance.
Right.
We've got a disease called FIP, and they're using remdesivir, I don't know how to say it exactly. It's the antiviral that people are looking at for coronavirus in humans with respiratory coronavirus. They're now using that for FIP, which was previously incurable, and now they're getting cured cats. And that's only happened in the last year. So there's a massive crossover, but there could be a hell of a lot more collaboration. There's still a lot of stigma, you know, in the different areas, and people not wanting to talk to each other, and funding is, you know, directed in one way and the other way instead of collaborative. Here, let's try and find the answer. We need vets and we need doctors to do it.
Yeah. Interesting. Human nature at its finest.
Oh, yes.
So you, you know, 20 plus years on, you're now an established figure. You're a pillar of the veterinary community. You're a family man. You
laugh at that, Angus.
You know, it's sort of a collegiate laugh as opposed to anything else.
All right.
Did you ever figure or ever perceive yourself to be in a leadership role?
I suppose my dad was always a leader, and my brother is a leader. And I think that we were brought up and given that opportunity to grow those parts of ourselves as kids and as adults. And I think it's our personalities that have put us into those situations. Pretty quickly on the rugby pitch, I found that we did better if I led in certain situations than having to listen to other people try and lead. So I think I didn't consciously set out in life to be a leader, but in a lot of situations, I find that I'm actually relatively good at doing it. So I don't mind doing it, and I've learned lots doing it, and now I feel quite comfortable doing it.
So in your role kind right now, you're sort of an organizational, so as you're speaking there, I'm thinking there's sort of two forms of leadership, I suppose, in your world is the organizational leadership, well, three, if you include looking after your family, and then you've got medical leadership.
Clinical leadership, yeah, absolutely.
What does that look like?
So at my role, I run a team of about 20 plus people. I have complete governance over the clinical standard that we practice at, and it's my job to get everybody to maintain that and to upskill to drive that and keep getting better with it. Another part is business management and clinic management. So how does the whole machine work? And how does it make money or not make money? And, you know, so that's the other hat that you tend to wear. And, I enjoy doing both different types of the job. And as for running the family, I've got a very capable wife who's very good at doing that.
She's the real leader.
I let her think so, yeah.
Yeah. So what for you defines leadership, James?
I think, well, leadership is simply somebody taking responsibility to take a group of people through a situation. And I think good leadership is trying to help everybody do better to get a good outcome that suits everybody.
It's very democratic.
Well, I find that I work in a people business.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks I work in an animal business, but I work in a people business.
Right.
You know, I can treat animals, but if I don't get people to allow me to treat animals, and if I can't get people on side, then I can't treat animals. So it actually works best if the human and the animal and the vet, all the client, animal and vet as a triangle all work together.
Yeah.
Then, you know, it's got to be collegiate. It's got to be, you know, democratic in a way. If the cat is scratching you and says no in the only way the cat knows how to say no, then, you know, do I force it or do I look at it and go, okay, I'm going to change tack. I'm going to listen to what the cat's saying and do something different and listen to the owner going, what's going on with my cat? So I found that being democratic is the best way for me to get actually the best results.
So, yeah, that's really interesting because, yeah, you're looking after people's what assets, if their animals are either assets, or if you come back to labor or transportation or food, but they're also family members.
These days I'm mostly doing, you know, pets. So, you know, they're their best buddies sometimes.
Yeah. No, my dog's mine.
Yeah.
What drives people to come into your industry? So you're a medical professional, that your team, I'm assuming, is made up of a whole range of personalities.
Yeah, so that this is one of the big quandaries of our industry, being that most of us come into it because we love animals and we have had or don't want to have, you know, human experiences and get better results by, you know, interacting with the furry friends instead of the human ones. So coming in, there's usually a change in people once they've got into the industry, realizing that actually you've got to like people if you want to make it in this industry, because you actually have to work with your teammates in a clinic and you have to work with your client base. And then you're working with your suppliers, and then you're working with, you know, your HR team or accountants or whatever it is. And you realize that you can't do anything without people. I mean, the world revolves around people.
So in your leadership role, what kind of challenges do you face if you've got these sort of reluctant socialites, if you like, who come to the profession for a bit of a, I don't know, escapism or want to be in a world that's just different to the mainstream, and then they're forced into an environment where they actually have to be more interactive because you're looking, as I said, looking after someone's assets or loved ones.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you're right. We have a lot of different personalities and we do personality testing. One of my roles with my practice manager, and we are a really tight team, is to pick a balanced team so that we've got the right personality in the right place doing the right kind of job, because there's lots of different roles and some are more or less client facing, some are more animal facing, some are more logistics, and you know, different personalities do better in those. And when the problem in a small clinic, you've got to wear lots of different hats, and can those people actually do all the different jobs? Most people can't. And then something falls over and then you've got a problem. So as your team gets bigger, you can start to pigeonhole people a little bit and say, you know, 80% of your job is going to be this stuff because you're really good at that. And we'll encourage you to, you know, do what you enjoy doing and improve on those skills whilst making sure you're at least competent in the other areas.
So that's where your desire to mentor and teach comes
absolutely
to the fore.
Yeah, I mean, I love seeing people come in with an idea and a feeling and, you know, a burgeoning passion of some sort, and helping them grow into something that they can be. Not something that I think they should be or something that they should be, they think they should be, but actually something that they can be.
Right.
And I think that's quite important, not pushing somebody in a direction, but, you know, encouraging it out of them and letting them go on the path that is best suited to them.
So you've just triggered a thought here. It's quite interesting listening to you speak. And I'm thinking around other personality types and leadership roles I've, you know, encountered, not just in this show, but also broadly through other areas in the world. Knowing what you know today with your leadership role in your veterinary world, what kind of person would be not suited for your role?
For my role?
Yeah, so you're leading a clinic, you're leading a team, you're looking after animals, you're a healer, a teacher, a mentor, a scientist.
Okay, well, I know this because I work with lots of different people, and some of them are more or less effective. If you are unable to adapt and wear a number of hats, so if you aren't actually, if you don't have a flexible personality, and you are very strong in one corner of a square, then you aren't suited to this role. So it doesn't matter which corner that is, because you need to be able to you know, work with all the different personalities
Yeah.
And do the make the hard decisions that are difficult and, you know, unemotional and pragmatic, but also have the caring and emotional side so that you can perform those duties that you need to do in that area and be able to talk to the animals and be able to talk to the people. So if you really don't like people, you shouldn't be in this job. And if you don't like animals, there are plenty of vets who just do it for the mental challenge, who then you probably shouldn't be in this job either. If you are overly emotional about, you know, I've got to save everything, and it is a big issue in our industry and something that we're looking at very closely, is that to get good grades and you are, you know, to be a smart person to get into vet school, which is what they say you need to be, which isn't necessarily true, but that's the current situation, then that attracts a high level of anxiety kind of person.
Yeah.
And somebody who tends toward perfectionism. And both of those things do not help you in being a vet.
Why might they be a hindrance?
Because it is a very emotional and mentally and physically challenging job, that if you aren't in control of yourself and you are prone to letting, you know, anxieties or other emotional feelings get the better of you, then you will struggle really badly. And that is why we have a massive suicide rate in our business.
Right. So that's, thank you for opening that door. You've opened two doors for me now, which I love. I love it when guests on the show do that. So we've got the mental health pathway, and we've also got the executive wellness or executive effectiveness pathway. They sort of dovetail, but which one would you like to go down?
Both of them. I'm happy either. I work for a national company.
Yeah.
That we have over 160 general practice clinics and 30 specialty clinics. And I'm on a mental health working group with 10 other members of staff, either vet directors or area managers, chief veterinary officer, head of HR. There's 10 of us in a working group, and we're working through the mental health issues and challenges that we have in our business and how we can try and improve that and then show that and grow that within the wider community.
So let's dig a bit deeper into that, because it seems to be pervasive across industry these days, top table subject. You know, my background is professional coaching, business and sports, and I'm seeing it everywhere. Mental health issues. I've spent some time in recent years in sports governance and absolutely horrified at the number of suicide issues in athletes, even young people who are teenagers. And I found that really traumatic, to be honest. It was not something that when I was a teenager or in my early 20s, the choice to commit suicide, it wasn't ever on the table. It was never an option. And yet today, we fast forward to now, you know, you've talked about suicides just now in the veterinary industry. There's a lot of military folks who've transitioned from military world to civilian world who just don't get it, feel isolated. So that becomes an option. A lot of businesses, high flyers, you know, the performance requirements are so strict and so tough. People are left without hope, and that they're looking at, if they're not committing suicide, they're self-medicating by other means. What are we doing right? Let's start there. What are we doing right? So you're part of a working group, which is great, and well done, and thank you. So what are we doing right in the world to combat this issue?
Well, I think many more people are talking about it. So we are now. So that's the first thing. Make more people aware that it's actually a real problem. Because like you said, you know, you didn't even think of it as an issue when you were growing up. it first became an issue for me when I was at school. Three people I knew committed suicide when I was at school. So it's something that we lose one person every 3 months in Australia to suicide in our profession. And not a lot of people realize that. Not a lot of people realize how much work and time and mental stress vets put into trying to do their best. And there's a massive disconnect between, like I was talking about at the beginning, you know, client expectation and reality. And vets then taking that on personally and saying, I'm trying, but I can't do it. And they want me to do it, and I don't know where to go. And they've got no money, but, you know, they want the best. And what should I do? And they feel very lost, some people. And I don't know. I can get very passionate about this subject. So I think what are we doing right is we're talking about it more, and there are many more places that you can go and call or talk to just at the drop of a hat. There are more courses available, mental health first aid courses, employee assistance programs are becoming standard throughout corporate world. And we're setting up groups so that we can continue to research and improve. I mean, one of the ladies who we work with, she's in lobby Scott Morrison's government for funding so that she can do more specific research.
Right. That's really sad, isn't it? You go into a profession because you want to do good in the world, and it sort of turns around and bites you like that. How do you, so there's two strands to this. How do you look after yourself to make sure you stay motivated and it doesn't basically eat away at your soul and trigger, you know, trauma or depression or PTSD issues for you, and at the same time look after your team, who, as you said, many will come into your industry to be away from people because they want to work with animals?
So I think looking after yourself is the first and the most important part of it, because my family, my mum's a nurse, she set up a nursing agency. My sister runs that. They care for lots of people in the home. I look after people and their animals. So we come from that kind of family, and you can't look after anybody if you can't look after yourself. You need to be fit and healthy to be able to look after other people. And for a start, a lot of people don't do that. I went to a really good lecture on it, and I think there's a fantastic psychiatrist or psychologist in Canada called Stephen Ilardi, who's done a study on, he took two cohorts out of an institution, and he kept one of them on their drugs, and they did their normal thing. And the others, he made them do 3 hours of exercise a day. He fed them a high fish oil diet, and he made them do something for other people. And at the end of the 3 or 6 month trial, like 38 out of those 40 people came off the medication and left the institution.
Wow.
So what it says is we are an animal that is supposed to move around a lot. Yeah. And the world has gone sedentary, and we got to stop doing that.
Yeah.
We cannot synthesize the fats that we need to make good brain connections. We have to eat it every day.
Yeah.
And the basis of who we are is we are people, and the world revolves in our own mind around us, but it's doing that together. We're social animals. It's about doing things with other people. So if you do something for somebody else, you get a good feeling.
Duh.
Yeah, exactly. Duh. But how many people actually do it on a daily basis, number of times?
Well, no, and that's, I think that's sort of the crux of an issue, isn't it? We, too many people are running to stand still in the world, and therefore the prospect of doing good for someone else is a nice idea, but not necessarily achievable in the same way of taking half an hour out of your life to go for a run or a walk with a dog or, you know, a couple of hours to play around golf.
And it's all of those things are important, and you need to learn what's important for you as an individual, what makes you tick, how much do you need of each of those kind of thing, and make sure you live your life that way as best you can.
So, and do you think, and I've had this regular theme across all the guests on this show and across all industries, is about leadership, walking the walk. So if you walk the walk on good behaviours, best practice, then there's a good chance that your team will walk that walk as well.
I do more exercise than anybody in my team. You know, I take tuna and avocado and rice crackers for lunch, and somebody else is going getting a McDonald's, and I'm like, you know, we've got a fantastic French patisserie next door to us, but I'm not buying cakes.
I'd be in there every day, mate.
it's amazing, and we get it for treats, but you know, I'm like, let's eat chicken and salad. Or we had a supplier come to us, and he said cakes, donuts, or health drinks. And I said health drinks. My practice manager was not happy because she likes cakes. So this is something that I'm really, I'm more and more conscious of, that we've got, I've become lactose intolerant.
Right.
And it forced me to eat differently. And it's annoying because I love cheese, but I've always had an unhealthy relationship with food because I eat a lot of it. And so now I have to be a bit more selective.
Yeah.
And think about it a bit more.
Yeah.
And with the availability that we've got, people don't think about it enough, and they just eat. And they eat the wrong stuff, and they eat too much of it, and then they don't burn it off.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
If you eat the wrong fats and you don't eat enough of the good fats, there's no way you're going to get a good brain function. No way. You're not doing yourself any favors in the brain department and, you know, being able to be the best person you can be.
Yeah, but I was reading a study recently about humans, and humans don't like logic. Even in the face of undeniable logic, they will almost always make a subjective choice.
Absolutely. But my dad was probably the most logical person I ever knew, and I'm part him, and he rubbed off on me a lot, so I can't help it. That's just the way it is. My staff don't like it, but I make them do things logically as much as I can.
Yeah, which comes back to mentoring and teaching.
Yeah.
But also you were talking earlier about democratic leadership, and then just now you gave an example of executive decision-making. I'd like to explore that a little bit. So the example of, no, you can have health drinks in the practice, not donuts or cakes. Yeah, very simple. It's an executive decision, which is, there's sort of a debate out.
There's plenty of chocolates there. I made that one executive decision because I could, as a balance to what else is happening.
Right. So and that's where I want to go with this question, because you see over a couple of decades, there's a lot of debate around about over-democratized leadership leads to nothing being done. Therefore, someone's got to step up and pull the trigger on a subject. Now, let's have a little look at that. How do you balance your democratic approach with the needs for executive decision making?
Well, I think it's there's a good statement in Australia, give a fair go. So, you know, you've got to give people a chance. And, you know, I am all for asking, well, what is the issue, and asking them to highlight what they think the problem is and what the solution options may be. and then we have a chat about those and where we might go and what which ones are the best ones to take for us. And I don't like using the words I and you. I use the words we and us a lot. Yeah. Because whenever we're talking, I'm talking with the team, even if it's a one-on-one or in a group of 10 or 20 of us, it's, you know, I'm on the same level. We're all in it together. And like, let's come up with where are we going to go and how are we going to get there? Yeah. So that's what I do. And then people will come up with it. And then I'll say, okay, so everybody happy we're going this direction? And we're going this direction. And then if we go down that road and it's not working, or we've all, because when we do a meeting, we've come to agreement, we then send out the minutes and everybody responds and that's, okay, that's written in and that's what we're going to do. And if then people start not doing that, then there's a little reminder that, yeah, you know, this is what we agreed.
Yeah.
And then we might look at some different strategies of how to manage an individual and a situation.
Yeah.
But we work a little bit further back in that we try very hard on selecting the right person so that it means the leadership is a lot easier.
Right. So prevention's better than cure. So you work hard, right, on your entry level employees, if you like.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then evolve them to fit the culture.
Yeah.
I'm going to switch gears here slightly. So in your world, how do you measure performance? So for the organization, I suppose, rather than an individual, what does good performance look like?
Every job has a job description. So on an individual level, do you fulfill your duties in your job description? And we have performance reviews. They're a positive discussion between two or three people about getting the staff member to self-evaluate and the manager to evaluate separately. And then we come together and then we have a chat and say, well, do you think that that's really where you're at, or could you be? And that's all subjective about certain points. So as an individual, it's very subjective. As a team, we have KPIs that we try to hit. And, you know, sometimes we smash them, sometimes we're not hitting them. And then we on a management level are looking at strategies to change.
So if your business obviously thrives on the well-being of animals, then it relies on, yeah, having sick animals. Is there a, yeah, shortage ever of sick animals, or are you, well, a recession-proof business?
Well, in COVID-19, veterinary business has grown 20% in Australia.
How so?
Because JobKeeper and JobSeeker has given everybody $750, but they're not allowed to go anywhere and spend it. So they've stayed at home with their dog and gone, crap, it actually does have a sore leg, or it's got a bad ear, or I've been meaning to get his teeth done. I'm going to take it to the vet because I've got this money now.
That's an irony.
Yeah. So if you hit on the irony of we're here for illness, and that's a common, I would say, misconception, because I do a lot of work trying to do wellness.
Yeah.
And what we're doing for staff, and, you know, insurance companies will give you a rebate on gym membership because they know that if you go to the gym, you're going to be healthier and you'll cost them less.
Right.
So we're looking at wellness and how to look after our staff better. They will work better. It will cost the company less. They will be happier. They will do a better job. And on the other side, looking at clients and going to them, say, you want your dog to live to 20.
Yeah.
Then we need to look at wellness stuff from 8 weeks of age.
Yeah.
Because brain development is working hard at that stage. Yeah. And, you know, So are people enlightened enough to do it? Some are, and some people are actively seeking it.
Yeah.
And others will accept the notion and the education, and others are totally not interested. But, you know, you keep striving for improvement. And where I'm saying that in that regard is, I think wellness is an important part for all of us. We don't look after ourselves enough.
Yeah. You're in the industry of wellness. This is fascinating, actually. I'd love to dig deeper into a bunch of different subjects here. But what I'm going to do is we're getting close to the end of the show. And I actually really appreciate you opening up, particularly on the mental health thing, because I think it's a very important top table subject these days. But I'm going to do a little sum up. So what I've heard you say in your world of leadership, your leadership layer cake is made up of empowerment, nurturing, education, democracy, with a little bit of executive willpower behind it.
You've got to be able to roll with it and, you know, play different hats when necessary.
Yeah, multifaceted then, yeah, very much so. So with that leadership layer cake out there in front of you, who do you see in the world today that's an embodiment of those attributes?
Oh, in the world today, shall I say Donald? No, I don't think Donald. I think I've always thought Richard Branson was a great leader. He's a people person. He's a look after your people, and people will look after you. And so I followed him quite a lot. And I think today, to be honest, there's more examples of how not to be a leader than to be a leader.
Yeah.
I think on the political stage, you look at Jacinta Ardern and New Zealand and her compassion and her obvious connection with the people that she's leading.
Yeah.
And her strength and integrity are something that you wish that everybody would have in that position.
Yeah, integrity is a big thing, isn't it? Interesting you raise that point, because I've had a few people who have struggled when they look out in the world to see, having gone through this process of identifying positive leadership attributes, are struggling to find those people in public life. And
I think another one, and you know, he's still around, is the Dalai Lama, is that his type of leadership is, you know, quiet and understated, but absolute integrity. And his message has always been the same. And he's been there for donkey's years, the whole of my life. And he's still positively doing his best, sending out the same messages to try and make those positive changes.
Right. So consistency is an essence of good leadership.
Well, yeah. I mean, if not necessarily predictability, but being consistent in being a good leader.
Yeah, fascinating. So that brings me on to, and we've talked about, you know, stresses of leadership, and one of the things I do, and I've done it on my journey for years, is listen to music and read. So in order to stay balanced, so exercise for me is a given. So I'm not going to fall through my own trapdoor there. I've always been quite good at exercise, but in terms of mental and emotional balance, always come back to music and reading. And so I'm intrigued in, given a choice, which piece of music and or book would you come back to maintain that emotional or mental balance?
So it's quite funny, because about 3 years ago, I stopped listening to any radio station except for Classic FM. So I only listen to classic music now, pretty much consistently. And it's far more calming. I don't have to listen to twits wittering on about whatever they need to. And, you know, And I think from a brain point of view, it's been shown that various different types of classical music are much better for your concentration and your thinking and meditation and so on. So on the driving out of work, you know, getting mentally prepared for work, leaving home behind, how do I get through that transition? Classic music helps.
Yeah.
And then after a hectic day at work, being able to zone out and listen to something new and try and focus on that and learn about a whole different area that, you know, a lot of people poo-poo and all of that, but if it's after 1985, I'm not really into it. So, yeah, classic music. And so there's all sorts. I've really got into Mendelssohn, Sibelius, and, you know, Philip Glass is on. And they have, I think, you know, the way they do it here, and I'm learning lots. So I just love the classic music.
Yeah.
And in terms of books, I love fantasy books. And I read the books, but a book that I would go back and read again, probably The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. It was 2011 New York Times non-fictional bestseller. It's an absolutely amazingly fantastic book that really has a lot of human stories in it, but a lot of science, and also helps people to understand where and why we are where we are with cancer, which is something that everybody deal with.
Yeah, there aren't too many people who haven't been touched by that illness.
Yeah.
So I love the music thing. Actually, it's because I am same as you. I've always been a lover of music, but in the last few years, I would say 90% of every music option I listen to these days is classical. Glad that you like Sibelius.
There's a good reason for it. There's a good reason for it, Angus.
It's professional maturity.
Yes. And emotional and personal and everything else.
Yeah. So then the last question I have on the show is for you to continue walking the walk on your leadership style and maintaining your own sense of being who you need to be as a leader, what's the one luxury item that you would take with you for the remainder of this journey?
A luxury item. Gin. Because you
there was a whole empire built on gin and tonics. You realise that?
Yeah. You need to be able to, you know, use things at your disposal in moderation to get where you need to go. And as we're slightly more venerable these days, we know how to do that better than we used to. A well-applied gin and tonic has vastly greater medicinal properties than people realize.
Yeah, I can pay tribute to that sentiment. So, James, that brings us to the end of the show. And I really want to thank you for your insights and opening up and, you know, wish you the very best with your practice and your vocation. And it's really good having you here.
That's been great, Angus. Lovely to see you and talk to you again. And hope we can catch up again sometime soon, maybe over a few gin tonics.
I love that idea. I'm booking a flight to Australia right now.